So today we are joined by a very inspirational man. I've seen a lot of his stuff all over LinkedIn, and I've had the pleasure of talking with him on many occasions. Today's guest is a mindset coach for high performers, helping people who are struggling with burnout, focus, or alcoholism. Today's guest is going to leave you pumped up and ready to take control of your life. It's Adam Smith. Adam, how are you?
I'm very well, mate. Thank you for that very pleasant intro as well. It's very kind of you. But yeah, it's great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Great to have you on the podcast. There's lots of places I could take it today, so I'm excited to see where it does go. The way we start all of our podcasts is the same, and I'm going to ask you the very same question that I ask everybody that sits in that chair. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Who am I and what problem do I solve? So, I'm obviously Adam Smith. I'm based in North Yorkshire, God's country. I'll fight you, Lancashire boy. I'm joking. the problem that I solve, really, to put it simply, I saw this a little while ago on LinkedIn. It's like, could you explain your business to a five-year-old? Not that I'd use this language, but it's to help people stop feeling like shit. And that can look so different for so many people because it just cuts through all the noise. There's no one problem that we solve necessarily. It's a combination of problems that are usually caused by the feeling of not feeling good enough from a young age. So it's a wide variety of challenges that we do help people with, either taking a break from or stopping drinking alcohol, how to get a more effective routine, how to become a more effective communicator. We work with very complex cases of DNA testing for professional athletes and CEOs to base level stuff. So yeah, it's a wide variety of challenges, mate, to be honest. We almost refer to it as like a mechanic of the mind. You come to me with a problem, but it might be a much more deep-rooted problem that you didn't necessarily know existed. So it might be able to look under the proverbial bonnet, as it were, and identify why your indicators aren't working, why you feel you need the proverbial oil change. It's not always the most obvious glaring issue, because it's usually something much more deep rooted than that. So I'm just fascinated as to what that story is, where that belief system began, and how we can help to reframe it to create a more compelling future for people, because that's what people want, right? They don't want to keep being in this negative stuck position that they currently are, and it's very frustrating for people. And unfortunately, people tend to focus on what they don't want over and over and over. And in the reticular activating system in the brain, if you keep saying what you don't want, you'll just get more and more of it. So we want to change that into a much more positive way of thinking and start focusing on what you do want as opposed to what you don't. So that's in a nutshell, but to put it simply, stop people feeling like shit.
Okay, I like it. I like that you can give me the layman's answer and the complex answer as well. Okay, good stuff. So I guess there's a lot to unpack there. And I think as we get deeper down into the conversation, maybe we'll go into like belief systems, because I know a lot of salespeople might be having money belief systems or kind of performance belief systems and different things like that. For anybody that's walking their dog or they're commuting on the underground and they're going to be listening to this conversation today, there might be moments in this conversation where they go, holy shit, that actually sounds like me. So before we get there, like, how would we, if you were a doctor and people were calling in and saying, I've got these symptoms, what signs, symptoms, thoughts, feelings should people be checking in with themselves to see if actually they do have the problem that you solve, to kind of first diagnose whether they fit into this bracket that they might need to make a change?
I guess that kind of falls on me to ask that good question as well. I'm fascinated by language and by the actual physical words that people say. And it can make you sound like a bit of a pedantic arsehole when you correct people on it, or you can hold the mirror up to them. When people say to me things like, I'm just in my comfort zone, Adam, I'm in okay shape and I'm only drinking a couple of beers a night and having, two or three takeaways a week, but I'm just in my comfort zone and I want to get out of it. Comfort. Is this comfortable for you? Is any part of what you're experiencing truly comfortable? And they're like, no. I said, well, you're full of shit then. It's not comfortable, is it? I said, oh, actually, no, it's not. So it's pretty fucking uncomfortable. Would you agree? Yeah, it is. Okay, no problem. So when did you first notice this became a problem for you? That's a good question. But most people go, oh, like 6 months ago, me and my partner started arguing. No, it is way deeper. What's the earliest memory where this became a problem for you? Oh, shit, I don't know. Because most people don't know what they had for lunch yesterday or can't remember. So asking people what's their earliest memory of this is a very big challenge. And that's the work that I do with people. So I'll help get them into like a deep meditation. It's not hypnosis or anything like that. It's just focusing your mind in a calm environment where I can ask them a series of questions and prod and poke and understand. Because most, if not all, of our initial belief systems begin from the age of 4 to 7 years of age. However, this can change. It can change through experience and it can change through external interference. If at the age of 5, your mum said to you, right, Jack, dogs are terrifying. And let's say you lived somewhere where there was not many people walking dogs. Dogs are awful. Don't go near them. They're vicious. They're going to bite you. And then a little Labrador puppy runs over to you and rolls on its back for its tummy being tickled. You might start to think a little bit differently. Equally, if mummy says dogs are amazing, they're wonderful and they're kind, and a Labrador walks over to you and bites your hand, straight away, you've developed a new thought pattern. So the external interference is mum saying what you should believe, and the experience is actually what happens. So you have to be able to differentiate between the two. Unfortunately, most of our emotional anchors, which is the thing that's been instilled in you from that young age, it just happens over and over and over again. So if mum or dad, when you come home from school, says, you go, mummy, mummy, look at my homework, and they go, not now, I'm not interested. Or you say, mummy, someone called me ugly today. Don't be so stupid, you're not ugly. Your emotional intelligence and your EQ is probably that of a 5-year-old still, because you were never allowed to experience the emotion. You were never allowed to feel it. So when you do get rejected on the sales call now, you may as well be the vulnerable 5-year-old running to mummy and daddy again, seeking their approval, because it's the exact same feeling. But this is so deep rooted in your unconscious mind that you don't even know why it's happening. You just think, I just can't deal with rejection. Maybe I just need to man up a little bit. No, it's way deeper than that. So I have to go back and understand that by asking the good quality questions like, when did you notice this became a problem, or what's your earliest memory of it? Just to try start to tap into that unconscious mind as best I can, and then help them reframe it in a more helpful way.
And just to carry on with that train of thought, you mentioned at the start it might be I'm having three takeaways and I'm in a comfort zone. There's a lot of drinking taking place. How does a parent not paying enough attention to me link with now I do that as an adult? What's the link between those two?
Great question. This could usually be that you feel like you don't deserve true happiness, so you attain a certain level of success, but now you want to subtly sabotage yourself. And you might not even realize you're doing it because, again, you can't have it all, right? I work with CEOs that are multimillionaires, that employ thousands of people, that have got the dream house, that have got the car, the wife, the kids, the picket fence, and the dog, yet still they're unfulfilled. And this might be a number of reasons. So they go, right, well, I'm doing really well in my career. Family are generally okay, but my body, that'll be the thing that I neglect because the deep-rooted problem. And again, this could be that dad worked away all the time, so when he came back, he wasn't that available. Because dad wasn't available that much, I craved his love even more. Dad's quite an aggressive man, he's a successful man, so who do I have to be in order to get my dad's love? I have to be like him. So I'm going to mirror his behavior, because people say I get my temper from my dad, I get my drive from my mum. That's incorrect. You don't inherit characteristics and you don't inherit traits. You might have a similar voice, you might look the same, and you might be some medical things that get passed down to you, but the rest is all behavioral. This is all watched and it's learnt stuff. So if you've watched dad become, air quotes, successful, at least financially, even though he was never available emotionally, and you want to get his love, what do you have to do? You have to be aggressive, you have to be forthright, you have to be critical. So this is something that you're going to carry forward unless you can heal that inner pain for yourself. And this is done by a series of ways. Number one is to create compassion for yourself because you were only a child and you didn't know any better. Number two is to create compassion for dad because he was just doing the best he could with the resources that he had from his father and his relationship with his mother or what have you. To sort of put a level of ease and peace with that. This can be done by writing them a letter and never giving it to them. This can be by writing a letter and giving it to them. This can be having a difficult conversation with him about how his behavior impacted you as a child. So people might think this is a bit of a stretch, but it's really not. No one just does anything. When people say, oh, he's just a dickhead or he's just rude, that's incorrect. Nobody's just the way they are. This has been, you know, deeply ingrained from a young age, and it's been reinforced positively or it's been reinforced negatively.
And once you've helped someone realise that connection, that's why that behaviour exists, and there's the through line from the 5-year-old, is that something that you can then put to bed for good, or do you always carry around an element of it? It's just a way of kind of dealing with it.
I think, again, that's a great question, and I think I'd say, unfortunately, it really depends. Like anything, we give everybody the same ingredients. It's just up to them on how they use it and what they do with it. So, you know, you could give 10 people a different gym program, for example, and they'll all get different outcomes. It's very similar to this. So I wouldn't say there's a black and white answer. What I will say is, for the probably 95 percentile, it's extremely freeing. At least they gain an understanding as to where and why it is there. Depending on the success going forward, will be determined by the work that they continue to do on themselves. I do exercises with them whereby we'll heal that inner child. We'll almost put them in a, deep meditation state. We'll get them to be fully associated. It's a method in neurolinguistic programming that is known as eliciting submodalities to eradicate cognitive dissonance, which is a load of jumbo, essentially meaning that, it's to free you of pain and get you towards your desired end outcome. Because the famous cognitive dissonance, which is sprayed around everywhere now, really is, you want to imagine you've got like 30 rubber bands around your fingers and you're pulling them apart constantly. Eventually, you're going to be in a lot of pain and the bands are maybe might even snap. This is what's happening inside your mind where you go, I want to be happy, Adam, but I keep drinking, I keep eating takeaways. There's a huge difference between those two things, so they don't align. I want to be lean and mean, but I'm eating kebabs every night. You're going to be in pain for the rest of your life because that's what's happening inside your mind. So, yeah, it really depends, mate, unfortunately. But I would say once you have healed this sort of inner child, we do an exercise where I get them to close their eyes, focus their mind, take them back to a memory where this began. You might not remember being 2, you might not remember being 3, but you might remember being 4 and someone pushed you over and everybody laughed. This has already created in your little brain at the age of 4 low self-esteem. My pain brings other people joy. So now, unfortunately, this is just the belief system. Then I go home and tell daddy about it. Daddy says, don't be so silly, son, you're overreacting. So now the person who I'm supposed to trust the most in this world has also disregarded how I feel. This is a huge problem. So what I do is I get them to almost close their eyes, imagine that they're outside of the room that they were told this by dad, and embrace their inner child. What would you say to little Jack? What would you say to little Zach? I would tell him it's going to be all right. I would tell him that he is loved. I would tell him that he is enough. The amount of men that I've done this with, and they completely break down emotionally or break through emotionally and become, you know, very upset, is really remarkable, because we've never been allowed as men to express this emotion without the fear of being judged or told we're a pussy or told to man up. So, short answer, it depends.
Okay, well, let's talk about sobriety. So you've got over 1,000 days no drinking, I think.
Yeah,
right?
3 years now, mate. Yeah, it's 3 years going strong. It's the best thing I ever did.
So what? Take us back to what inspired the change. What was the moment that you thought, I've got to do something about this?
it, it was kind of a combination of things, really, mate, to be honest. I say I had it easier because I decided to stop in lockdown, but my coach corrected me on that and said, that's bullshit. It wasn't easier for you at all. How many people started drinking more in lockdown is actually quite a high number. But I was in hospitality working, in that industry for 14 years. One of the venues that I managed towards the end of my career, the owner was amazing, like nicest guy in the world. Managed a bar in Leeds called Jake's Bar, very famous, synonymous with going out and getting absolutely shit-faced as well. But you drink with your guests. This was very much like a not a requirement, far from it. He'd never told me to do that, but it was almost like an unwritten rule whereby people come to see the bartenders at Jake's. You go to some of the more glamorous venues, like your tattoos of the world, because you go because it's a status symbol. You get the photo at 20 stories and you feel good about yourself and people like it on Instagram. Jake's Bar was somewhere you went just to have a great time, great drinks, and get a high five from the bartender and have a shot, right? So this obviously became a huge problem though after a while, because when 20 or 30 people come in and ask you if you want a shot and you say yes to everyone, there's 28 shots to a bottle of spirit. And you'd throw in a few beers and a few gin and tonics. I don't tell you this to impress you. I used to probably drink in excess of maybe on a Saturday night, it could be a bottle and a half of spirit and 10 beers and still be absolutely fine. That is horrendous and it haunts me. When I think about it now, the smell of alcohol makes me want to throw up now. But I knew I was done with it, to be honest with you. I'm 35 now. I knew I was done with it probably when I was 18. That sounds ridiculous, but I hated drinking. I hated the feeling it gave me. I liked the initial buzz, but then I hated feeling out of control. And there's a very slippery slope when you're on the piss with the lads, lads, lads on a Saturday night. And I used alcohol as a crutch. I used it as a mask. And, it was the only time where I felt like I could sort of step outside of myself, and people resonated with this character that I'd created. It gave me a false sense of significance and importance when people came in the bar wanting to high five me and give me a hug, when in reality they probably just wanted queue jump and free drinks. And I couldn't differentiate the difference at the time. I just thought, no, this is fine, it's good, I'm making all these great connections. And I was, don't get me wrong, not everyone was out for something. I got on well with a lot of people and I have very fond memories of hospitality. But when lockdown hit and I was probably 3 stone overweight, drinking too much, I was getting in from work at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning on a weekend. Something had to give, and my skin was terrible, my sleep was horrific, my anxiety was through the roof. I was so unproductive, low energy, you name it. And I just decided I'm just going to take a 30-day break. And that's what I'd recommend for anyone, by the way. For anyone that's, I hate using the word sober curious. It's been done to death now and it sounds really wanky anyway. Who says that? Are you sober curious? No, no one speaks like that. If you're sick of feeling like shit, of going out and getting pissed all the time, take a 30-day break and you'll start to see all the benefits yourself. It's quite frightening, really. And then I extended it to 60 days. And then I just thought, right, I got to about September, October, and I said, I'm definitely going to drink at Christmas. You have to drink at Christmas. That's just a story, right? We all have stories. We all have belief systems. This was one of mine. But it got to Christmas Eve, and I thought, right, well, everyone's locked down anyway. We can't go out with a mate. So I'll have a Baileys tomorrow. Didn't have one. Didn't fancy it. So just, if I can get through Christmas, that'll be fine. If I can get through my next birthday, that'll be fine. And then it just kept rolling from there, and all the benefits just kept getting better and better. So, people caveat this all the time and say, I wouldn't say I've got a problem, Adam. Well, no, there's being 10 pounds overweight and there's being bedridden because you're obese. They're both still probably a problem. So no, I wasn't searching for the empty cans of Foster's in the morning, desperate to get a little touch of alcohol, but I certainly wasn't in control of my drinking either, and it had to stop. And people often tell me, you're wrong, it's all about moderation, Adam. Well, that's really subjective. Your moderation might be one beer a month, somebody else's moderation might be 2 beers a night. there's a huge difference between the outcomes of those two things, of course. And I say this all the time and I mean it. If you can have one gin and tonic at dinner and you're genuinely happy, genuinely healthy, I'm jealous as fuck because I never figured out how to do that. But I can moderate the food that goes in my mouth. I can moderate my emotions, but I couldn't moderate alcohol. And there's a lot of guilt and shame around that. You've got a problem because you can't moderate. Well, has 67% of the UK got a problem because they can't moderate the food intake then because of the obesity crisis? Or how about we lose the judgment? How about we become more open-minded and maybe ask some more questions? So, yeah, that's sort of my journey with it, really. And now I help people take a break, focus on the different things that they can do, because most people associate the pain of change to be worse than the pain of staying the same. And there is no pain worse than the pain of staying the same if you're struggling. It's just going to be a different pain that you're not familiar with. Because to go back to the point I said earlier, it's not the comfort zone that you're in. You're just in the very familiar zone. That's all this is. It's just familiar. You're familiar with being overweight. You're familiar with being pissed. You're familiar with having low energy. You're familiar with arguing with your partner. You're not familiar with waking up at 6:30 in the morning and feeling full of energy, full of life, and having a thriving marriage. But it can be that way. And this, you know, it's not that alcohol ruins everything. It doesn't. But does it make anything better? No, it doesn't. So, yeah, you don't have to have a problem with it to reassess your relationship with it.
I want to come back to the moderation discussion in a moment. I guess in terms of your personal story, there's a few places that I'd like to take it that might be a bit challenging. And if they are, feel free to tell me to piss off. I guess probably twofold. If we were to get the magnifying glass out and the microscope, because of the theory of how you actually help people now, like, I'd be keen to know, like, from your point of view, and if it does go too personal, honestly, we can just skip it. That's why I'll give you two lanes to take. But I'd be really keen to understand, like, your inner child and that effect, why you might have struggled with the moderation. And I'd also be keen to know, if we really looked under the magnifying glass, the effects that alcohol had on, like, your relationships. And I mean that term as in family, friends, romantic partners, all of those things. So there's two lanes there, Adam. I'll let you pick the safest option.
As you probably understood now, my answers aren't very short, but I'll do as best I can. So my inner child, I've got ADHD and I've got dyspraxia. This was undiagnosed until the age of about 15. So all the teachers just thought I was a little shit. They just thought I was only there to cause problems and distract others. And I must have been a nightmare for certain teachers, because there were times where, ADHD or not, that was just a bit of a dickish thing to do. But I was so angry. I was such an angry kid because I was misunderstood. This is what my coach helped me with. Because I've got a coach, and I'll never, ever not have a coach of some description, by the way. Because I'd be a bit of a hypocrite if I professed the benefits of coaching and then didn't have one myself, I think. But also, you need someone to call you out on your bullshit from time to time. And I said I was a little shit. He said, you weren't a little shit. You were misunderstood. You were confused. You were angry. And you were angry because, you know, I'd look up at the whiteboard and then it almost like the words have disappeared. And then because of the dyspraxia with the fine motor skills, I was trying to write down so quickly I couldn't even read my own writing. So when it came to homework and looking at notes, I don't even know what I've written down. There was no teacher support back in my day, right? There was none of that. So it was very challenging. So I got so annoyed that I was used to just distract others. So I would seek my validation through humour, so I could get attention from other people by making them laugh. And this was how I developed self-worth until I got thrown out of class. And there was no phones to play on. It was just me with my thoughts. And I used to fucking hate it. It was exhausting. I didn't like the fact that I couldn't keep up. I couldn't like the fact that this was my only way of doing it, was to either make people laugh or ridicule other people in order to make myself feel better. And I did it through sport. So I just ended up becoming good at football and tennis and whatever. And dyspraxics have no right to be good at sport. because again, it's fine motor skills, especially things like tennis. That's just almost unheard of. So, but I did it over and over and over again. So I have this level of resiliency when people doubt me to go, fuck you, I'm going to do it anyway. So with the alcohol side of it, I think it showed up in terms of people pleasing. It showed up in terms of trying to gain as much connection as I could, because that part of me was unhealed from not feeling good enough from a young age, never feeling like I belonged, always feeling misunderstood. So what do? I surround myself with people who want to go out and get pissed all the time. So therefore they do understand me and I do feel like I'm part of something, finally. But deep rooted, deep down, I knew this was not serving me and I knew that it wasn't helping me in any way, shape or form, but I continued to do it due to the low self-worth and not feeling good enough. So it's a very slippery slope when you're chasing the validation. I've worked with, I used to work with a model. She was as beautiful as you can imagine. And she used to, you know, post photos of herself smiling, and then lo and behold, it got less and less clothes down to like a bra and a G-string. But the bra and the G-string picture didn't get quite as many as a smiling. Oh, it's my body, Adam. My body's disgusting. No wonder people didn't like the photo. No, that's not what it is. It's you're chasing the validation in all the wrong places, and this shows up for people in various different ways. So yeah, that was a huge part of my past, was never ever feeling good enough. So even recent times when coaching and you don't land a certain client, that feeling, that horrible gut-wrenching thing of not being good enough, my job is to bring in new business. If I don't do that, then I'm putting on my worth and achievement again, right? I don't know if you, have you guys read The Chimp Paradox? Yeah, so the refrigerator gremlin that he refers to, and you come home from school and you say, "Mummy, look at my drawing." And she goes, "Wow, this is amazing. This is beautiful. I'm going to put it on the fridge where everyone can see. I'm so proud of you." And most people listening will go, "Well, what's wrong with that?" Well, what's wrong with that is you just acknowledge my achievement rather than me as a person. And this isn't me knocking mum and dad, by the way, because they were great, but we're so wired to do this as people, as opposed to saying, "Hang on a second, that can wait. Come here, give me a cuddle. I'm so proud of you. I love you so much. Now, what do we have here? Did you do this? Oh, wow, this is amazing." It happened a few weeks ago when we won an award for A Game. I text my mum saying, "Look, winners." And she put, "This is amazing. This is so good. I'm so proud of you." So it's like we're all still seeking that little level of inner child, I think, every day in some way, shape or form, if it hasn't quite been met yet. And I certainly did this with alcohol to like the nth degree, just trying to feel like I was acknowledged in some way, in a positive or negative way. I just didn't want it to be stuck in my own thoughts anymore. So when I removed that, unfortunately, a lot of people get rejected when they stop drinking alcohol, because their friends say, you know, they won't necessarily go, "You're not coming out with us anymore," but they'll just stop asking you. And then people go, "But Adam, I've stopped drinking now and I've lost all these friends. Maybe this is the wrong decision." And they start attaching all the wrong meanings to it again. No, stick with it. You'll find your people. They're just not the people that were their drinking buddy for 20 years, I'm afraid. Big difference. So yeah, chopping people out of my life that didn't serve me was absolutely necessary, because I stayed stuck in that victimhood and that vulnerable child as much as possible, really.
We spoke with a previous podcast guest who's called The Big Positive Guy, and he was saying that the first step to positivity is cutting out those negative people. So I love everything that you were saying, and obviously Zach's got four kids, and I can imagine when the youngest two start school and they're running in with their pictures, there's going to be a remembrance of this moment and be like, right, okay, what's the perfect way to parent? Okay, so moderation, and I know that you've got your views on it, but I'm sure if we brought someone, and I would probably agree with you personally, from somebody who drinks maybe every couple of months, every now and then. I went out on the weekend and I'm paying for it now a few days later, so, and I'm close to saying, you know what, it's not for me. But I still feel like there's that moderation bit where, yeah, I can balance it. I believe that we could sit here with some really high successful performers, people that turn over millions or billions, that have got a happy family, good parents, all of those things, and they can drink. Moderation, I think you're going to give me your 2 cents on it like you did earlier, but do you not think that alcohol can be part of a happy life?
Great question. A very provocative one as well. Honestly, yes. Can it get even better without it? Also, yes. And the most important word there is even, because yes, there are some very successful people financially who are, you know, again, very healthy, very happy. But the thing is, you don't necessarily understand what it's doing to you unless you track it. And what I mean is, having a device like Whoop, for example, we've just taken on a client the other week, and he is all the things you just said, multimillionaire. He flies his gym equipment around the world with him. That's how wealthy he is, right? Great family, successful business, yada, yada, yada. Now, he really wants to knock booze on the head. That's one of the main reasons why he signed up with us. And he said, I want to start it in 3 weeks. I'm going on a family holiday. I said, no problem. We're ready when you're ready, okay? There's no shining a light on your eyes. You don't have to stop drinking to work with me, by the way. But let's just look at it. So he got his Whoop day one. He had one beer. That's it. One beer. And he sent me his metrics the next day. And sleep performance was 88%. And he said, see, you can sleep well. Let's look at the metrics, though. REM, 0%. Light sleep, 1%. To give you an idea, these regions should be anywhere between 17 and 25-28%. I said, right, I'm going to set you a challenge. You've spent a lot of money with us, and I'm going to set you a challenge, okay? Go just one day without it, because his recovery was appalling. His recovery was about 40%, even though all he did was go out for a medium to long size walk. So the next day, he exercised intensely, and his sleep performance was 77%. But this is without alcohol. His metrics increased. He had less sleep, but his sleep performance was better. His REM was 19%, and his light sleep was about 24%. Now, as a successful CEO, I asked him, do you ignore data in your business? He said, no. Is 2 + 2 = 4 in your business? He said, yes. Well, if you carry on drinking, then you're fucking stupid, because these metrics are ruined. And he started laughing, because that's the kind of vernacular that he uses too. But he's like, holy shit, one drink. I said, one drink. That's the difference. Now, the reason why I'll never drink again is because I like to think of myself as quite logical and intelligent at times. if you've got a glass that's got a beer in it, and you've got a glass that's also got a beer in it, they look and taste the same, right? But this one's just got no alcohol in it. So you're not missing out on anything. People go, oh, but what, I'll become really boring. No more boring than repeating yourself. No more boring than, oh, God, I'm hungover today. Oh, God, I'm not productive today. Right? That's really boring to me. So it's not, again, what's wrong with one. It is what's right with one. And the answer is nothing. But if you're just doing it just because, very occasionally, no, it's not going to ruin your life. Of course it's not. But I think, unfortunately, mate, like I said at the start, it's just too subjective, moderation. And people do sort of kid themselves a little bit about the effects. Or you simply might just not know. I didn't know. I didn't know how one drink can ruin my sleep. I didn't know that it made me so unproductive. I didn't know about how much it can impact my libido. I didn't know about how much it can affect my testosterone levels. I had no idea. But when I gained the information, I was like, oh my God, this is what one drink does. So having one or two a night, you're operating at about 70%. So if you are the millionaire and you're killing it, you might not be in the best shape though. Or you might be the millionaire in great shape, but you might be snapping at your kids a little bit. You might be giving them the iPad because you can't be asked to play with them. You can't be asked to play with them because you didn't sleep very well. You didn't sleep very well because alcohol is actually a sedative and it knocks you out. It doesn't help you sleep whatsoever. So that's the only thing I would put back to it. I honestly don't give a shiny shit if people drink alcohol or not. It makes no difference to my life at all. But if you want to address your relationship with it, we've got some great resources in order to get you past that and changing your life for the better.
I stopped drinking last year on the 8th of December, and a lot of people always ask me about the pros and cons, and I'm sure you're the same as me. The pros are like, I've never slept better in my life. It's like a massive, massive list of pros. And there's probably one con, but it's one con because you've got to plan around it a bit. And it's the alcohol relationship I had was, if I'd had a tough day or even a really good day, it was just a natural, like, take the edge off kind of thing. And there was like an immediacy to that taking the edge off. So I've had to put other stuff in place, like doing jiu-jitsu in the morning is like a preemptive stress relief. But in terms of people who say, well, then how do I get that immediate, like, it's a stressful day, and that's when I'd reach for the bottle, what would you say to those types of people that have got those, like, the millionaire's lifestyle or the CEO?
Yeah, to be honest with you, mate, I would very much go down the James Clear method here, which is to hack that habit. I say to him, I don't want you to change that habit at all. It is really painful changing a habit. It takes a lot of work, many years. There's so many theories on this, but it can take ages. Now, don't get me wrong, if you're on your deathbed and the doctor stops smoking, yeah, some people will unfortunately carry on smoking, but there'll be a small percentage that can change overnight. So what I do is I get them to do like a physical walkthrough of what the habit is and which element of the habit they actually really like. So we've got another guy again, very successful, whatever, single, divorced, got a dog, high stress job, got really good friends around him and all that sort of stuff, but he's a bit lonely, so he used to drink to sort of as a bit of a comfort. So all we did was literally swap out the alcohol-free, the alcohol beer with an alcohol-free beer, like, pour the rest down the drain, give it to a neighbour, whatever. I said, talk to me, what happens? Well, I get home from work, then I take my jacket off, then I put my bag down, then I walk to the fridge, and then I get the bottle and I open it, and it, when it goes tss, I said, do you like when it goes tss? It goes, yeah, so great. Then I pour it into the glass, and then I walk over to my sofa, and I said, let me guess, you turn on Netflix, and it goes doo-doom. He's like, yes, when you go doo-doom, then I know how to relax. But then I sit down, I'm stroking my dog, and I have a sip of beer and go, said, what if you didn't have to change any of that other than just the liquid? In a day, it changed. And this is, again, to put into perspective, this isn't aimed at, like, alcoholics or whatever. This is mid-lane. He has a beer a night or two beers a night, right? He's like, what the hell have you done to me? I was like, I've done nothing. I said, all we've done is swap out the liquid because I don't want to change that habit, right? Because that's the bit. It takes about 5 to 6 minutes for your brain to register it's actually consuming alcohol. So it's not the alcohol you crave. It's probably just the refreshing drink. It's probably the, you know, the association that you've got to sitting on your sofa and stroking your dog while watching Netflix and drinking the beer. There's so many more complexities to a habit than just, I like to have a beer after a hard day. But even then, the beer is causing the hard day. Right, it's not helping the hard day. So it's also diving into the belief system, because that beer, let's say he is married with children, means his sleep's poor, which means in the morning when the kids are jumping all over him, he's stressed, he's looking at his phone, he's got more emails to deal with, he's even more stressed, he's now stuck in traffic on the way to work, even more stressed, when he arrives at work the client has got on his back and he's really agitated, oh for fuck's sake. And then he gets home, oh, I've had the day from hell. I just need another beer. And repeat. As opposed to meditation, as opposed to journaling, as opposed to jiu-jitsu, as opposed to alcohol-free alternatives, there's so many other things you can do to maintain or manage the situation, as opposed to relying on a story that you've attached to a liquid to make you feel better and make you, air quote, unwind or take the edge off or loosen up a bit, right? So it's way more complex than that. So we have to, again, dive into that. What's the story first and foremost? What's the habit? How can we change it? Talk to me. What part of the habit do you love more than the other? And then you can hack it as opposed to just changing it and stopping drinking alcohol and becoming a boring recluse.
I love that. So much more sustainable to change the habit rather than hit like a cold turkey type of thing, and then the cravings are all going to be there. Have you, we like a story, especially when we're speaking to someone like you. Have you got maybe someone who was a particularly challenging example? Obviously, you don't have to give us any names, but maybe a scenario they were in where it was quite challenging for you to get anywhere with them, and then there was just something that happened that broke the camel's back?
Yeah, interestingly, it was actually a policeman, and this makes this story even more mental when you take into context what they were doing to him. So they went on a night out, and it was a Christmas do. Obviously, keeping in mind these people are here to uphold the law and to protect us, right? Now, he arrived. When he walks in, everyone's like, oh, you know, we'll say the name's Dave. He wasn't called Dave, but Dave, how you doing, mate? Oh, usual, is it? Pint of Jägerbomb. And he just signed up with us like, you know, 2 weeks prior. Now I just have a Diet Coke. Oh, what? It was almost like the music stopped and the lights were, you know, on this guy. There was about 10 of them. And they were basically, not literally in a circle, like pointing at him, but it wasn't far off, making him feel like utter shit. So he's like, no, I'm just having a Diet Coke. A Diet Coke? Are you fucking joking? Stop being a pussy, mate. Come on. Someone went to the bar and bought him a Jaeger without him knowing. And two of them grabbed his arms and they were trying to pour Jaeger in his mouth. And these are all policemen. So the Jaeger's pouring all over his face and all this, and he snaps and says, get the fuck off me. And one of them is more senior person, his boss. He's like, who do you think you are? You need to uphold, you know, you can't be physical in a bar. You can't be doing this. You can't be doing that. So, well, you've just grabbed me and tried to pour alcohol down my throat. Yeah, it's a laugh. It's a lad's night out. What's up with you? Well, what's up with me is I don't want to drink alcohol. I don't have to explain myself anymore. Long story short, this went on for a rough idea for about an hour of the peer pressure. It almost got to a point of abuse. I don't like to use that word lightly, but they were calling him every name under the sun, attacking his character. You know, you've never fit into this team anyway. Who gives a fuck if he drinks? Blah, blah, blah. They were smashing like 3 or 4 pints in this hour and a few shots, becoming even more unreasonable. He actually folded and he drank. He said, I can't be out. I'm just going to drink. And then he went out the week after with another one of his mates, and then he did it again and he drank. And he just woke up and he said, I've just felt like utter shit. Because he was trying to push this away. He was trying to resist this as much as possible. I'm fine, Adam. I'm fine, Adam. I'm fine, Adam. And there's a most brilliant question, which I'd highly recommend you two use on sales calls. Have you had enough pain yet? And he literally burst into tears. My coach asked me that question about 18 months ago, and I had the exact same reaction to a different situation. And I was just like, it just poured out of me. I was like, I've never had it in my mind as, have I had enough pain yet? I literally used this on a sales call, by the way, an hour ago before I came in with you guys. And I said to him, I mislabeled him. And I said, you haven't had enough pain yet. And it took him back. I have. Well, if you have, you'd sign up. I don't think you've had enough pain yet. So let's walk away from this. And when you're ready, reach back out to me. Rather than, I'll think about it. I'll come back to you. Right. So when I asked that question, it hit different. And he just got out of his own head. And he realized that I've been asking myself all the wrong questions this whole time. So we have a lot of people that are very resistant at first, and then they start to see it unravel. And we've got a community of over 50 other CEOs and high-performing execs and business owners, and they see, used to go out every Saturday, now I'm up at 6 on a Sunday, smug as fuck, going for a run, right? Eventually, like I said earlier, who you hang around with is who you'll become. If you hang around you with really negative people all the time that are using deprecating language to other people and just gossiping and bitching and moaning about the fucking weather or traffic, that's what you'll start to do as well. And it's no different with this. Surround yourself with people that want to get up in the morning, get after it and whatever. You'll see a much better outcome than hanging around at the fucking dog and dickhead with Dave and Dan and getting shit-faced till 5 a.m. drinking fucking WKDs or whatever. So, it's really like heartbreaking to see sometimes the pain that people go through in what I do every day. But the trade-off is the benefit of how amazing they can feel when they get out of their own head and start to make the changes. So yeah, I'd probably say that one was the most extreme example of the of overcoming the adversity when it comes to booze.
An incredible conversation, Adam. I've loved the. I know that we've engaged a lot about sales, and we've spoke a lot on LinkedIn about different question strategies and things like that. And I've absolutely loved how our audience is going to be a lot of salespeople and people in this line of work. And I love that there's so many similarities. And I always think that I think probably one of the easiest. Not easiest, because I don't want to take that away, but I feel like if you're selling, what we're trying to do is find the problem and find the pain. So I feel like in your line of work, it's a real like good place to start in terms of like what you do, and you actually help change people's lives. An incredible conversation. Thank you for being so open and honest. If people want to work with you, they want to check you out, where should they go? What should they do?
Well, unfortunately, when you type in Adam Smith, it's the most common name on the planet. So on LinkedIn, you're probably better off actually typing in A-Game Consultancy or my business partner's name, which is Adam Mayhew, because you'll find me through default on there. Finding Adam Smith might be a bit challenging. We do most of our work on LinkedIn, to be honest. Website-wise is www.agameconsultancy.com. I'm on TikTok as Alcohol-Free Mindset Coach. And yeah, that's probably about it, mate, to be honest. But by all means, if someone is ready and they want to make changes, then I've got a good experience for you, for sure.
Thank you so much, Adam. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, mate.
That was great. Really enjoyed that.